This morning's topic is part of a sermon series on fasting and feasting. So you all have heard a couple of these now. This is about learning to let go of those things that drag us down or pull us away from God, and learning to practice those things that add meaning to our lives, that help us encounter God more fully. So today, we are thinking about fasting from discontent. And I realize in a room with this many people, we're all probably in different places. Some of you might be pretty happy right now. Life is going pretty well. Things are going well. Some of you might be in a pretty dark place where you're just hoping and longing for things to turn around. But I'm willing to bet a lot of us, even some from those first two groups, are in sort of an in-between place. Not tortured by anything, not deeply depressed, just kind of blech, stuck, restless, or discontent. There was a Huffington Post blog recently, which I don't know if any of you all read that. I read that for the news, different opinions on the world. They have a lot of great articles, and they had an article that suggested these five signs that you're restless with your life. And some of them are going to sound pretty familiar. Number one, you're unhappy at your job. You're bored at work. You're overwhelmed or unappreciated. Number two, you don't know what you want to pursue. You don't know where you're going or what your life means. You're just kind of in this weird in-between place. Number three, you don't have time for the things that really matter to you. You want to feel driven by a purpose, but your life wears you out so much so that at the end of the day, you just want a big nap or maybe a couple of hours of Netflix. Number four, you're passionate, but it fades really quickly. So you might go through a cycle of, I'm really motivated and I'm excited, but then you procrastinate and you're disappointed again. And we all go through that kind of a cycle. And then number five, you're easily overwhelmed. So you think that life can be better, but you don't really know where to start. And you look at all the problems of the world. Where does anyone even begin? It's all so overwhelming. Again, you just want a big nap. So those are the five things that the Huffington Post said are signs that you're feeling restless in your life. And I wonder if any of that describes you. It felt very familiar to me. You can see what I mean, though, in hearing those things, that you might not be crying yourself to sleep every night, but maybe a lot of you, a lot of us, deal with a gnawing sense of discontent. So you'll catch us saying things like, oh, well, when we finally buy this house, we can relax. Or when the kids finally go away to school, we'll have more time for each other. Or when work slows down, I'll be able to focus on my spiritual life. True happiness when you're dealing with discontent is always elusive, following something that needs to still take place. It never feels quite in your grasp. And there's another interesting article that I happened upon back when I worked in Washington, D.C., and it was exploring the connection between wealth or privilege and then what they termed existential angst, which is really just a fancy way of saying discontent. This article looked at Bethesda, which is an area you guys have probably heard of, maybe visited. Bethesda is one of the richest zip codes in the whole country. It's one of the most highly educated in the whole country, and it's in one of the healthiest regions in the whole country. So you would think that these people in Bethesda had the secret to the good life. But the writer interviewed tons of psychotherapists, and they all contradicted that idea. And one in particular described these seemingly happy people this way. She said, they may have been able to successfully complete their mental checklist of what their life should look like, yet they still feel unhappy or have a gnawing sense of emptiness, a sense that something is missing. And when I read that, I think that is a perfect definition for discontent, just that sense that something is kind of missing. This is something that afflicts so many of us, and it's so troublesome precisely because it is so elusive, hard to get our hands around, just right beyond our grasp. What does this have to do with our scriptures today? Well, our gospel describes a true mountaintop experience. We've heard that phrase before. How many of us have had those mountaintop experiences? We have those moments in life where everything else just falls away because we're so caught up in the joy and awe. For me, I have a few that I could think of right off the bat writing this sermon. I had a moment of a mountaintop experience many years ago when I was on a youth retreat, and I recommitted myself to God, and I felt invigorated. I felt ready for anything. Nothing was going to get in my way. And then another example that many of you have probably been through is my wedding day. I felt the most beautiful I had ever felt, and I was about to marry the man that I love, and everyone I love was in the same room ready to celebrate with us. And then for some of you, probably you think of the birth of a child, holding that little miracle in your arms for the first time. That's a transcendent experience, a mountaintop experience. So whatever it was, we all had those mountaintop moments where we could convince ourselves that nothing is ever going to go wrong again. We are so happy that we don't know how we ever felt fear or doubt, and nothing is going to happen from here on out. Discontent feels like a distant memory. But then I came home from retreat into a world of college application stress, a breakup with a boyfriend that was very dramatic, and pressure to be my happy, bubbly self still. Then the wedding is over and you come home and you have to figure out whose stuff goes where and who has to do which chores and all the very unglamorous stuff of marriage when the wedding is over. And then that little miracle sleeps only 2 hours a night and makes you think that you're gonna just lose your mind, right? So just as we experience those mountaintops, all of us, we also all experience the tough coming down from those mountaintops. I don't know about you, I've done a little bit of hiking, but I think coming down from hikes is harder than going up. You get out of breath going up, but coming down, you've seen the view, you're kind of over it, your knees hurt, you just want to go home. Coming down's tough, and it's hard, and Peter had a tough time with it too. Jesus had just been revealed in the gospel story in all his glory as the true Son of God. And alongside him stood Moses, the liberator of the Jewish people, and then Elijah, their greatest prophet. Peter had been in the trenches with Jesus, and now he was seeing him for who he truly was. It was a revelation. It was amazing, glorious. And so, of course, Peter didn't want that moment to end, and he doesn't even know what to do with himself. So he does something kind of weird. He starts building tents. Maybe they can all just stay up on the mountain forever. After all, he said, it is good for us to be here. If Peter had any inkling whatsoever of what was to come for Jesus, all the suffering that was to come, it's no wonder he wanted to stay up there. Don't go back down with all those people. We're having a great time right here. So how do we handle coming down from the mountains? There's a writer, Oswald Chambers, who writes a beautiful devotional called My Utmost for His Highest, with little prayers and meditations each day. And in one of them, he talks about this. He says, the test of all mountaintop experiences or visions of God is what you do when you are in the soup of actual circumstances, how you handle that part. And we just heard how Peter tried desperately to hang on to that mountaintop moment. He tried to delay going back down into the real world. And what about Moses and the Israelites? Their story's a little bit more complicated. Their mountaintop moment had already happened. It was the Exodus from slavery. God had literally parted seas to get them to freedom. But now, that's over, and they're wandering. They are lost. And they felt restless, discontent. And where was Moses? He got to go up to the top of the mount and see God face to face and have another mountaintop experience. And you can imagine what all these people were thinking. The rest of us have to stay down here, waiting all this time. What is he doing up there? He wasn't just up there a couple hours. He was up there a couple of weeks. Are we ever going to settle down somewhere? Where is this promised land we've been promised? They got really impatient. They got so restless that they could not wait on Moses or on God anymore. And so they built that golden calf. They desperately built something that they could just see in front of them, that they could touch with their hands, because they needed to reassure themselves that something, anything, was looking out for them. They built an idol because they were so uncomfortable. Now, we might not relate to that story because we really don't feel tempted, I think most of us, to build physical idols. But we have to remember the Israelites did not have iPhones. They did not have laptops. They did not have the gym or the news or wine or TV or any of that stuff that we have to distract them from their discontent. So this is what they did. They gave into it. I heard a really great sermon on this story recently from Pastor Joyce Myers. Probably a lot of you have heard of her. We don't agree on everything theologically, but I like Joyce Myers because she is spot on about human nature and how messed up we can get sometimes. And she said something that stuck with me all week. And she said, self-pity is idolatry. Self-pity is idolatry. And why? Because self-pity, what it does is puts us up on a pedestal. It has total tunnel vision to the point that all we can see is all the way that things are unfair for us, all the ways everyone else is doing better than us, and all the ways that we're not getting what we deserve. And the Israelites fell into that trap. We all fall into that trap. I fall into that trap. So people like to think that pastors are real holy people, but I think we're some of the most messed up ones of all. And I'll tell you truthfully, before I got this call, I had a time of being in a very dark place myself. As pastors, we want to fix the world. We want everything to be good. We see everything through the eyes of hope. So hard times are tough to take. I went through a dark time that affected everything. I had ended a job with my former church that I really loved. And I knew I wasn't going to get to talk to these people for months or years. And I had to go into an office job where I had a huge pay cut. And I was basically just making copies and ordering food and not using any of my skills. And there were no new churches in sight. And I felt discontent. At first, it wasn't so bad because I told myself, this won't be for long. This is just temporary. But then it started to feel long. And then it felt longer. And I started to feel sorry for myself, and that discontent spiraled away into a place of deep resentment and entitlement and self-pity. So the kinds of thoughts like this: God, look at all I have done for you. This is how you repay me? Is this how you treat your ministers? Maybe I'll stop applying to church jobs if this is how you're going to be. I'm better than this. What is the point of all this waiting? I didn't say it out loud to anybody except maybe my husband, but God knows my brain was swimming in thoughts like that, that sour, bitter attitude. And it affected my prayer life, obviously. It affected my marriage. And it is only by God's help and God's grace that it didn't keep me from becoming a pastor that you would call here, because it could have completely changed me. It could have been something that transformed me into a permanently bitter person, and the PNC would have said, mm-mm, not right for us. So we all go through those kinds of things, and we're not proud of it, but we just get lost in discontent. So what are we supposed to do? What is the antidote to discontent? Our two scriptures today do not answer that directly. But the whole of Scripture does. Sometimes that happens. If you look at the whole of Scripture, there's an answer. The antidote is gratitude. So verses like, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God for you, from 1 Thessalonians. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His steadfast love endures forever, Psalm 107. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, Hebrews 12. It's all over the Bible, gratitude. It's simple, but it's not easy. I'll say that one more time because this is a lesson I really had to learn. Some things, they're simple, but they're not easy. With gratitude, we say thank you like it's nothing, 20 times a day, to people who open a door or give us a Coke at the drive-thru or help us on the phone. We say, oh, thanks, have a good day. Yeah, you too, thank you. We say it a million times, but allowing real gratitude to take over our hearts when they are inclined to be bitter and discontent, that's not easy. It takes constant effort. But gratitude can start with something as small as just waking up. So shaking out of autopilot and really seeing our lives, getting out of that tunnel vision. Peter almost missed that mountaintop experience. I don't know if you caught that, but he and the other disciples were heavy with sleep They were this close to falling asleep and missing the transfiguration. And we all are like that too. We might be heavy with sleep, with burdens, and we're missing things in our lives unless they slap us in the face. Just because our everyday experiences of parenting or building a life with somebody or working an honest job don't seem very glamorous, that doesn't mean that there isn't glory in them. In fact, I started thinking about it, and I think maybe Peter should not have needed to see Jesus lit up on the mountain to know who he was, because he had been God with him that entire time. Jesus had been God that entire time. This transfiguration story is not God magically turning Jesus into the Son of God. He had been there the whole time, walking in the dirt and touching the untouchables and breaking day-old bread. It was just hard to see. So maybe we also don't need a mountaintop experience every day to see our lives for what they are, to see that what we have is really beautiful. If we feast on gratitude, then maybe we can train our minds to see differently. How we handle everyday life is part of our witness to the world. It shows the world how we see God, what God means to us. And I know I'm ashamed that my witness was shabby and hollow. I've told you before, my parents, my husband, so many people in my life are not Christians. And when I was stuck in that self-pity, my witness was terrible. But we aren't perfect, and we are going to mess up like that. So I'm not going to dwell in the past, and neither should you. That's not why I remind us that we get stuck in this cycle. Lent, however, is a good time to recalibrate our minds, to change our expectations of what this faith life is going to look like. Because the life of faith is not about tunnel vision. It's not about self. It's about service to others. It can't all be on the mountaintop. It's more like the climb up and the stumble down, and we're lucky we get those mountaintops. There is an author that I know a lot of you guys like, and I like too, called Bill Bryson, and he wrote a book called A Walk in the Woods, which sounds really pleasant, but it's about him hiking the 2,100-mile Appalachian Trail when he was not physically ready to do it. And he planned it with excitement, but he describes it like this. Quote, "The hardest part was coming to terms with the constant dispiriting discovery that there is always more hill. The thing about being on a hill, as opposed to standing back from it, is that you can almost never see what's to come. Each time you haul yourself up to what you think must surely be the crest, you find that there is in fact more hill beyond, sloped at an angle, and then beyond that slope, there is another, and then another, and beyond that, even more still, until it seems impossible that any hill could run on this long. But still you stagger on. What else can you do?" End quote. There will always be more hills. That's the way life is in this world. I wish I could tell you differently, but we know that's true. And yet people of faith can see beyond what the world sees, beyond the struggle and the huffing and puffing. We can see the journey. We can see the beauty and the kindness and the purpose and the ever-present help of God. Can you see it? Right over that next hill. So we should just keep climbing together. May it be so.